Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 24, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we are honoring the memory of a great friend of the Federalist Society with the second annual Mike Lewis Teleforum. Professor Michael W. Lewis was a veteran scholar, father, and husband. His specialties were in the areas of the law of armed conflict and international humanitarian law. And today, in his honor, we will be discussing the Obama administration's December 2016 release of a comprehensive report on the legal and policy frameworks governing the use of military force. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are pleased to have with us Mr. Stephen Bradbury, who is a partner at Deckert LLP, Mr. Philip Carter, who is a senior fellow and director of the Military Veterans and Society Program, Center for a New American Security, and Mr. Adam Klein, who is a senior fellow also at the Center for a New American Security. Today, I will turn it over to Steve to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you, gentlemen, for speaking with us. Steve, the floor is yours.
Terrific. Thank you so much. And let me just say at the outset how honored I am to participate in the teleforum in memory of Professor Lewis. Michael Lewis was a great scholar, a great patriot, and a big friend of the Federalist Society, and his passing at the very young age of 50 was certainly a shock to me and a great loss to us all, but it's an honor to participate in a teleforum in his name. The topic today is a report that the White House under President Obama put out just last month, December 2016, kind of on the way out the door of the outgoing administration. And it's a report on the legal and policy frameworks guiding the United States' use of military force and related national security operations. It's a sort of compendium describing authorities and limitations for the use of force that have come to be recognized by the outgoing administration, and kind of represents a summary compilation of their views about these authorities and the limitations that apply. And much of the substance in this report is a reiteration of descriptions of authorities for the use of force and how the Obama administration was going to approach issues arising in the war on terror, what I would call the war on terror, that were contained in speeches, testimony, various other releases by the administration. The report is largely descriptive. It describes both statutory and constitutional sources under domestic U.S. law for the use of force, as well as the international conventions, treaty obligations that impose limitations for the United States in its use of force. And it describes the particular application of the use of force in various specific theaters of conflict involved primarily in the war on terror, Afghanistan, Iraq, the fight against ISIS in Syria, etc. It then has a long description, which again is basically just descriptive of the established limitations that apply on the use of force under international standards, the laws and customs of war, the Geneva Conventions, various humanitarian law. It has a short discussion on the prosecution of captured combatants in the war on terror, and also the standards and limitations that apply under U.S. law for the transfer of detainees. Mostly it is taking on what I would think of or describe as easy issues and simply summarizing encapsulating, describing established standards. There are some exceptions where I think it does make a strong and positive contribution. I think if you're familiar with the report, on page 6 of the report, it has a description or an argument as to why the Obama administration has concluded that ISIS is properly targeted as the object of the use of force under the 2001 authorization for the use of military force following 9/11. Because ISIS is an outgrowth of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I tend to agree with that analysis very strongly, and I think that's a positive contribution. In terms of describing international limitations on the use of force, I think it has a helpful discussion reminding folks that under the UN Charter, an action in self-defense is not limited to actions taken by nations following an actual armed attack, but also may be taken in response to an imminent potential attack. And then similarly, there's a helpful discussion indicating that under those international standards, a nation does not need to reassess the threat prior to each subsequent action taken in response in the use of self-defense. So I mostly agree with the descriptions of standards captured in the report, but I do have some criticism with the structure and the emphasis, how they approach it, and I'll get into those criticisms in a minute. But in terms of general observations, let me say that I think this report, it strikes me as mostly a public relations document. I think it is in furtherance of President Obama's emphasis on transparency on these issues because of controversies that have arisen in the past about the executive's assertion of authority in the war on terror. And I think as part of that, the outgoing administration is very interested in emphasizing the limitations that it recognizes on the use of executive authority. I also think President Obama and his outgoing administration were interested, as most administrations are, in institutionalizing the positions, the structures, the accomplishments, the approaches they've taken. But I have some doubt as to whether this report will actually achieve much in that regard in terms of, for example, predetermining how the Trump administration would approach issues. At the same time, I do think it could be helpful in supporting future actions because it's now clearly documented, at least in very general high-level terms here, that the Obama administration did take a position or one or another position, which would be helpful to future administrations just in terms of making it clear for the public. I do think, I will say, the report ignores some very tough issues that came up during the Obama years in the use of force, which are not addressed here at all. I think it fails to confront what I think is a real need the country has for a new AUMF in the war on terror. I would like to see the executive and branch and Congress come together in a new framework for addressing this ongoing conflict. At the same time, I just have to say, though, I'm actually happy that the Obama administration did not end up pursuing the goal of negotiating a new AUMF, because I have a feeling they would have agreed to what I would view as constitutionally suspect limitations on the use of force. Similarly, I do think we need a permanent structure for the use of Gitmo as a detention facility going forward. Of course, the Obama administration was committed to ending that and closing it, but it remains an issue that will continue. Another issue that came up and raised a lot of controversy during the Obama administration was the use of force in Libya in support of the efforts to overthrow Gaddafi, and that's not addressed here at all. And, of course, that was not authorized by Congress. It relied on a Security Council resolution, and there was a real issue there about compliance with the War Powers Resolution because historically the United States has taken the position that flying fighter jets on bombing missions over a foreign nation does constitute hostilities, putting armed forces in hostilities. But as you may recall, the Obama administration, after actually getting a contrary opinion from just the Justice Department, ended up settling on a conclusion that the bombing flights in Libya did not constitute hostilities. And that allowed the administration to avoid the very significant constitutional issues raised by the War Powers Resolution, which purports to put a 60-day deadline on the termination of hostilities. Past administrations have taken the position that that's unconstitutional, or at least raises serious constitutional issues, and President Obama was able to avoid that issue. It also doesn't, the report doesn't talk about the actions in Syria to support the potential overthrow of Bashar Assad and the so-called red line questions, which there was no statute authorizing actions passed by Congress. And so the president would have had to rely on Article 2 authority under the Constitution. But turning back to what actually is in the report, I want to sort of quickly highlight what I view as some issues or problems with the report. And first of all, let me say there's just one big objection I have, and that is that right on the front of the report and in various places, it uses what I view as a grammatical abomination, and I just have to tell the world that. They put an apostrophe after United States to purport to make it a possessive, and my view is that's something we should eradicate. It makes it look like United States is a plural term. Anyway, just had to get that off my chest. But in terms of the substance of the discussion of the bases for the use of force, I think they have it kind of backwards when they talk about the domestic sources for the president's authority, because they start out with statute, the AUMF of 2001, and then they relegate to the second position the president's authority under Article 2. And if I were writing such a report, I think what I would suggest is that, like any sovereign nation, the United States has the inherent right to take military action in its defense, in defense of its interests and the interests of its allies. And under the constitutional system of the United States, it is the president, under Article 2, that has the primary role in carrying out that authority, that sovereign authority for the United States. And all actions taken by the president in response to foreign threats that involve the use of military force have to start with Article 2 as the source of that authority. Obviously, Congress has a critically important role under the provisions of Article 1 for funding the military, setting up the rules that constitute the military, declaring war, which of course has only happened four times in the history of the country. And a statute like the AUMF is an important confirmation by Congress of the president's use of force, and it is a supplement of the president's authority, but I wouldn't start with it first. The report also cites the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, suggesting that that is in some way authority for the use of force. But of course, the NDAA, as Congress expressly said, did not add anything to the AUMF. It was really addressing detention authority and adding some particulars to existing detention authority. Ironically, the report starts right off on page 2 by referring to the War Powers Resolution and the reports under the War Powers Resolution that the president has issued, where troops have been put into hostilities. Of course, the War Powers Resolution is not a source of authority for the use of force, though past administrations have pointed out that it does confirm the background understanding that Congress recognizes that the president may need to use force without statutory authority. But it is just a little more than ironic for this report to start out with a reference to the War Powers Resolution and completely ignore the issue that arose in Libya with the sort of manipulation of the terms of the War Powers Resolution to avoid the hostilities question. The report also cites appropriations acts, apparently as evidence of congressional authorization. I think that's dubious. The War Powers Resolution, by the way, expressly says that you can't do that, that no appropriation shall be taken as evidence of authorization. This practice of relying on appropriations as evidence of congressional support or authorization for military action is something that has occurred in the past. Walter Dellinger, when he headed the Office of Legal Counsel in the Clinton administration, relied on various appropriation statutes in discussing authorization for use of force by the Clinton administration in Kosovo. Again, I think this is the kind of sort of twists and turns the administration may take when it is reluctant to rely on Article 2 of the Constitution, the president's inherent authority under the Constitution as the primary source. I will just a couple more minor points, and then I'll turn it over to Phil. In terms of the conflict with ISIS and the authorization for that, there's a footnote in the report that relies on the 2002 Iraq AUMF as authority to use force against ISIS. And I just must say, I don't find that argument persuasive at all. That was use of force against the government of Iraq at the time and the Saddam Hussein government. And I just think it's a real stretch and doesn't really work for ISIS. The last thing I'll say is there's a discussion based on legal opinions that the administration has previously released about the targeting of U.S. citizens abroad who may be participants, enemy combatant participants, you know, fighting against the U.S. But I do take issue with one aspect of it. It raises the Fourth Amendment as a set of considerations that need to be taken into account, treating the targeting of an enemy combatant as a, quote, seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And I think that is overblown and not really persuasive. So with that, let me turn it over to Phil to share his thoughts on the report. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you very much, Steve, and thank you all for joining us today. So I come at this from a slightly different perspective that I'd like to share, and I'll open with a vignette that some of you may have heard. It's not an apocryphal story, and I think it illustrates maybe part of the why this document came out. So at one point in 2009, then White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel was describing his views on a handful of topics that were vexing him and the administration at the time. And he said, look, I'm like an air traffic controller, and there I've got these two big 747s in the air trying to land at JFK. One of them is Afghanistan, and the other one is healthcare. He's told it a couple of times. It could be healthcare, it could be the economy, but in this case, it's healthcare. And there, on the runway, like an effing flock of pigeons, you can imagine Rahm Emanuel's real words, like a flock of pigeons is Guantanamo. And that attitude is part of the backstory for this document. For the White House over the last 8 years, the Obama White House over the last 8 years, counterterrorism was an important topic. In some cases, in some situations like the bin Laden raid, it was the most important thing they were doing. But it was competing with a number of other priorities, particularly domestic priorities that required legislative attention. And so it never got the full political capital of the White House, and it never got the full legislative and executive investment by the president himself that was necessary. And I think one of the big effects of that was to leave the Obama administration's national security framework largely uninstitutionalized. There's no permanent executive order in this space beyond the three that were signed on the day after inauguration. there was no meaningful statutory change during this period, notwithstanding the NDAAs and funding statutes that Steve notes have limited value. There was no amendment to Executive Order 12333, the sort of talismanic executive order for the intelligence community. There were obviously many, many, many presidential policy directives and classified directives and so forth, but the kind of permanent legacy documents that could live on beyond the Obama administration are absent. And so I think that's the ultimate reason why we have this document in front of us today, is there's this sense that, hey, we fought for 8 years, we conducted more raids and more drone operations and more fill-in-the-blank than any administration in history, and yet for the thing that we care so much about, the legal architecture for this, we've really done very little. We have some speeches, we have these orders, but we don't have anything lasting, except for this document. What's interesting about the document, though, is that it largely restates what we already know. If you were to read the probably five key documents, the Obama administration's filing in March 2009 in one of the first detainee cases to come up, you would see its definition of who is a lawfully detained combatant. If you were to read its briefing materials in the Alaki case, both before and after his death, you'd get a sense of their authorities on targeting and the conduct of hostilities generally. If you'd read some of the notifications to Congress surrounding the Libya operation or some of the speeches from people like Jay Johnson or Harold Coe, you'd already have a sense of these legal authorities. The only thing missing is the cover page with United States mispunctuated, as Steve notes in his remarks. So let me just briefly describe a couple of the vexing problems that this framework still leaves unanswered, and I think that remain for the Trump administration as they take office, despite all that's transpired in the last 8 years. One is that we are conducting war on a broad front, doing a lot of things that resemble traditional military activities, like what we're doing in Afghanistan and Iraq today, but also a lot of things that fall somewhere below the threshold of war and probably count more as state competition or state versus non-state actor competition or something else, to include security assistance, foreign assistance, intelligence activities, foreign internal defense, unconventional warfare, and so on. The list could really go on forever. The U.S. military currently has troops overtly deployed in more than 150 countries, and it's likely the case that we have military or intelligence personnel in every country of the world. To do this, the Obama administration is relying on a broad patchwork of authorities, many of which cannot be reconciled, and many of which are never really evaluated in parallel with each other to get at, you know, what's the best way to do this legally and from a policy perspective. And stepping back from a policy perspective, there's often no meaningful evaluation of these tools and frameworks against each other. So if we choose, for example, to arm the Syrian rebels or work with the police in Colombia, at no point is there ever a decision in the National Security Council sit room or another forum that asks, what's the best authority to do this? What's the best tool in our arsenal of statecraft to do this? What agency ought to be empowered? Instead, I would argue, and this document confirms, we look for the greasy path. We look for the path where there's an existing legal authority, an existing appropriation, or some way that we can do this that will align with past similar operations. Nowhere in there is there a calculation of optimal performance or optimal outcomes, and that's bad for policy reasons as well as legal ones. The second problem, and this is a more narrow problem that this document confirms, is that there remains no congruence between our authorities for hostilities, for targeting, for detention, or for prosecution. And as the Pentagon official who was responsible for detainee operations in 2009, this created all manner of problems for me, and it's created problems for the Obama administration as well. So if you're conducting an operation, hypothetically in Somalia or Libya, under one authority, you might engage a particular person, and you might pick that person up, or you might capture them through liaison services and hope to bring them back to the United States. Unfortunately, the authority that you targeted them under is likely broader than any authority you might detain or prosecute them under downstream. And so you're left with this detainee, and this probably applies to a great part of the Guantanamo legacy population as well, this detainee for whom there's no good prosecution option. There's no good option under the Military Commissions Act as amended. There's no good option under Title 18, particularly given the retroactivity problems with the material support statute and its extraterritoriality. And there's no other good options other than continued law of war detention until the end of hostilities, which, is the third problem that the document flags, that it defines the end of hostilities in a way that is very open and very much arguably something that will never happen. That is good from the perspective of leaving it to executive discretion. It's good from the perspective of making that really an operational decision for the president and his advisors and his generals to decide. That is arguably not a legal decision, but it's bad to the extent that it really doesn't set any sort of meaningful limit on war. And it leaves us in a state of forever war or perpetual war that's probably not good as a normative matter for the United States going forward. The final issue I'd say is I agree with my colleague Steve and I agree with my other colleague Adam. The document really doth protest too much when it talks about the AUMF of 2001. It is very clear that it has reached its useful limit with respect to the extension to cover groups like ISIL or new groups that may emerge on the horizon and needs to be updated. I'm also skeptical that a new AUMF could have been updated last year, the year before, given the conditions on Capitol Hill and between Capitol Hill and the president. The geographic and temporal and substantive limits would have been too severe. But a new AUMF, which is more consistent with the current U.S. position in the world and our current targeting set, would be useful and would probably have a number of other positive externalities besides just clarity from a legal perspective. I'll pause there and hand it over to Adam.
Thanks, Bill. Going third, I don't want to cover too much of the same terrain as my predecessors, but I'll just list a few things that I think are interesting and jumped out at me from the document. But first, I'll start with what I think the purposes are. I largely agree with Steve that it's about, and Phil, that it's about the president's legacy. Largely on the left, frankly, to show to posterity or to attempt to show to posterity that he is not the president who presided over a quote-unquote forever war, as Phil said, or the drone president, as many have accused him as being, but showing that he was indeed constrained by law and was this constitutional lawyer that the media constantly lauded him as. And to some extent, I think it's an extent to constrain the Trump administration. It's uncertain how successful that will be. But at the end of my remarks in a couple minutes, I'll just list a few ways in which I think the document does highlight some potential constraints that the Trump administration will have to face as decision points going forward. But first, on the issue of a new AUMF, I came into this when I read the document thinking that the application of the 2001 AUMF to ISIL was a stretch. The argument that ISIL's DNA, was its original sin, its birth in al-Qaeda, somehow carried through its very public split with al-Qaeda leadership. But I was surprised when I read the document, the articulation of the argument here by the Obama administration, to find how persuasive it was. The idea is, in short, that the Zarqawi group in Iraq became part of al-Qaeda in 2001 and then fought U.S. forces for years. And the administration argues, and I think persuasively, the fact that they later developed a feud with the current al-Qaeda leadership doesn't strip the president of his extant authority to fight that group. And indeed, they make the point, which I also found persuasive, that so holding would effectively give the enemy control over whether you can target them based on who they declare their allegiance to. Now, I, like my colleagues, have long been a believer in the value of doing a new AUMF. I don't think that value is principally is practical. I think in practical terms, the president has both the legal authority that he needs under this argument, but also the public support and legitimacy that he needs to fight these groups. But I think the value is principally for Congress, frankly, to defend its institutional prerogatives to decide under the Declare War Clause who against whom the United States goes to war. On that note, something else that irritated me, frankly, was the reference to the president's authority to initiate hostilities against Libya. Steve referred to the 2011 Office of Legal Counsel opinion. And for those who aren't familiar with that, basically the premise of that was that launching a bombing campaign against Libya was not war because the hostilities would be of limited duration and intensity. And frankly, I found that unpersuasive and absurd at the time, the idea that an unprovoked bombing of a sovereign state would somehow not be war. And it hasn't grown on me since. And I think that there's a substantial irony to the fact that this president, who campaigned against quote-unquote executive overreach, has found himself now adopting theories that as a candidate we can assume he would have denigrated. On international law, something that no one has flagged yet, There's a discussion of the unable or unwilling principle. This is the idea that it's okay to attack a terrorist group on the territory of a third state, of another state that doesn't consent to the operation, if that state is either unable to take care of the terrorist threat or unwilling to take care of the terrorist threat. And so, for example, Syria is an example of this. Is unable to combat ISIL, and the administration argues persuasively, frankly unwilling, to devote its full attention to the ISIL threat emanating from its territory. And I don't have any quibbles with this principle at all. I think there's a widespread international consensus around it. Two interesting points here. First, we might just want to think about and be cognizant of the possibility that our adversaries, for example, Russia, will at some point want to weaponize this principle to use against countries in their near abroad that we would support. So, for example, Ukraine has various militias that have been active in the fight against Russia. Just something to think about whether Russia in the future might try to employ this principle to justify military action there. I also found it telling that the responsibility to protect was not mentioned in this document at all. This was advocated by the sort of humanitarian interventionists in the Obama administration, like Samantha Power. The principle is that the international community has a quote-unquote responsibility to protect civilians that allows it to take action against states that are committing atrocities on their own soil. And that principle, it appears, will not form part of the Obama administration's legal legacy. On the end of the conflict, I respectfully disagree with Phil. I agree with his factual statement that the Obama administration's description of when the war ends is nebulous and open-ended, but I think that's inevitable, frankly, just because of the nature of the conflict. That being said, and I've written on this before, there are things that Congress could do if it was deeply concerned about this nebulousness to create a better structure for as a practical matter, deciding when the war ends. Specifically, we could have a separate statute governing detention at Guantanamo, something Steve alluded to, governing our use of law of war detention, providing for individualized determination so that for those detainees, the war's end will be determined on an individualized basis rather than based on this nebulous idea of when al-Qaeda is defeated. I won't dwell on that too much longer. I'll move on to targeting. Again, there's nothing original here, as my colleague said, but I think it does usefully restate a couple principles which I think we'll all agree with. Specifically, the idea that it's okay to target an identifiable member of an enemy armed force. So some of the advocacy groups on the left have called drone strikes against individual identifiable members of al-Qaeda or the Taliban assassinations. And this document very clearly refutes that. I think that's accepted by all of mainstream members of the national security law community, the idea that, for example, if an enemy general's plane is flying, the classic example is Admiral Yamamoto in World War II, it's okay to target that individual. It's not an assassination. It's the normal conduct of hostilities to target that identifiable member of the enemy force. Also, the principle that drones are not somehow special, that it's okay to use such technologically advanced weapons in the same way that you would fire the same munitions from an airplane or a hot air balloon or any other mechanism that you might use to conduct an airstrike. So I think it's good to have the Obama administration clearly on record as behind those principles as well. So the last thing that I'll talk about, something I alluded to earlier, are a few areas where potentially actions taken by the Obama administration might constrain or at least will create decision points for the Trump administration. So one thing that falls into that category is the presidential policy guidance on targeting lethal actions. It's really called the drone playbook. That's the colloquial name. And it contains various self-imposed limitations that even the Obama administration doesn't assert are required by law, but that it applied to strikes away from a traditional battlefield. So, for example, they limited themselves to targeting only those terrorists who pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. They required a near certainty that no civilians would be harmed. They would do it only when capture was infeasible, and they did it only where the local government was unable or unwilling to take action. That playbook also created a detailed internal process for making decisions about drone strikes, and it required congressional notification of each strike. And so the question is, will the Trump administration preserve these constraints, but will it also preserve the procedures? And if it wants to substitute its own procedures, that will take time and effort to design. And so that's a decision point that the Trump administration will have to confront. Another potential constraint is the executive order that President Obama issued in 2016 on civilian casualties from drone strikes. It requires, for example, annual public reports about the number of civilian casualties from U.S. strikes. And that's something that the Trump administration will have to decide whether it wants to preserve or whether it wants to issue its own executive order to revoke that. But either way, it will have to do something. Another example is Guantanamo. There are 41 individuals there in the residual population. 26 of those have been deemed untriable and sort of indefinitely detained under the law of war. One thing to watch for is whether there will be new arrivals. And finally, on interrogation methods, Executive Order 13491, which was issued at the beginning of the Obama administration, Phil alluded to this, limits all U.S. personnel to only techniques in the Army Field Manual, which is pretty restrictive. And then in the 2016 National Defense Authorization Act, Congress codified that limitation. And so the question is whether the Trump administration will seek to preserve that, whether they'll seek to change the Army Field Manual, in which case they'd have to notify Congress, and whether they'll try to add new techniques to that limited stable of techniques. So with that, I'll hand it over and back for question and answer.
Okay, very good, gentlemen. Let's now go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One programming note, our next telephone forum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. That call will provide an update on the latest at the CFPB. That call will feature Wayne Abernathy, who's the Executive VP for Financial Institutions, Policy, and Regulatory Affairs at American Bankers Association, and also Jerry Lozier, who is of counsel at Winston & Strawn LLP. Currently, the audience question line is wide open. Gentlemen, one question I had in listening to you all is it seemed that you all indicated that a new AUMF is desirable, and I was curious if you all would like to comment on, you know, how a new Trump administration AUMF proposal might carry forward some of the proposals made by the Obama administration in 2015 and or how it might differ.
This is Steve, and I'll jump in. I cannot purport to speak for the Trump administration or what it might do. I really don't have any idea. But I could conceive, based on the president's broad description of the war on radical Islamic terrorism, as he conceives of it, that he would take a much broader approach if proposing an AUMF to govern these hostilities than would President Obama. Past proposals floating around both the executive branch and Congress have focused on the idea of a group-by-group incremental authorization. And, for example, itemizing specific groups and then a procedure for adding new groups to the list. And I could certainly see a President Trump going in a very different direction and having a sort of new updated general description of the threat facing the U.S. and the authorization for what to do in response to it. The other aspect of the last go-round in discussing these issues was, of course, the limitations. No major ground forces, et cetera, and I would certainly hope and expect that the Trump administration would not purport to agree to any such upfront limitations on the scope of how the president may decide to use force. The other thing, though, is it could include a mechanism for the president to notify Congress and maybe Congress to take some action in terms of the sunset of the authority, the end of the hostilities, helping to define that. And I really like Adam's idea of detention authority for Gitmo with detainee by detainee individualized determinations. That I think makes a lot of sense.
Okay, very good. Phil or Adam, any additional comments on that?
I think Steve's right in the sense that a lot of the limitations are going to be antithetical to the Trump administration, whether they're geographic or substantive in terms of the groups available for targeting or the methods to be employed or temporal. But leaders in Congress on both sides, whether it's Bob Corker or Tim Kaine or others, have really signaled an unwillingness to give any AUMF that has no limitations at all. And so I think this becomes a trade-off between the president, who probably wants much broader targeting authority and is probably entitled to get it, given the campaigns that he ran on and pledged the American people he would conduct against ISIS and others. But I think to get that, he'll probably need to trade a temporal limit or some sort of a mechanism, as Steve says, to come back and negotiate for additional activity at some period of years.
Yeah, I'll just very quickly add that, as Steve and Phil have both noted, the main problem in the last Congress in getting a new AUMF, despite widespread agreement that one was desirable, was the issue of geographic limitations, so which countries the president could pursue ISIL to, and the use of ground troops, Democrats wanting both limitations and Republicans wanting neither. In theory, unified Republican control has increased the odds that a relatively clean ISIL AUMF can move without those limitations. I will slightly disagree with Steve. As something more of a congressional partisan, I'm comfortable with an ISIL-specific AUMF and might even prefer that to a broad sort of global authorization to wage war against radical Islamism, however execrable a philosophy it may be. But I think an ISIL-specific AUMF, just a simple clarification that the authority conferred in 2001 extends to the Islamic State would be satisfactory, and it doesn't need to substantively expand or contract the types of powers that were conferred by the 2001 ISIL AUMF.
Okay, very good. Looks like we have one audience member waiting to ask a question. If you would like to join the queue, again, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Let's go to our first audience question of the day.
Thank you, gentlemen. I have two short questions, and I'd like to be muted after I ask it. The first one is based a little bit along the lines of the opening comment about the apostrophe at the in United States. This is about the broad definition of war that I've been listening to you all say. If terror is a tactic of warfare, how do you end war on a tactic? To me, that's a very basic question. And the other one is, how can they properly define an enemy if the lexicon of war fighting doctrine is prescribed in such a way that you can't use the opposing side's own terminology?
Yeah, I'll speak to that a little since I've written on, at least to the first aspect, because I've written on the end of the war against terrorist groups as a concept. Clearly, you don't end war or even make war against a concept, although the formulation war on terror has a certain utility. And conceptually, of course, it is true, or at least I believe it's true, that we are at war against these groups and their ideology. As a practical matter, as a legal matter, we are at war against specific identifiable groups that Congress identified in the 2001 AUMF, right? So those who planned, supported, aided the 9/11 attacks, or those who harbored the perpetrators. So that's a specific identifiable set of groups, and that's who we are legally at war with. Now, the challenge is identifying the precise moment when that war comes to an end. And obviously, that's the source of the indefiniteness of this conflict. It's not the impossibility of conducting a war against a non-state actor, it's the difficulty of identifying the endpoint. But that's a practical challenge rather than a conceptual challenge.
Okay, very good. And we have another call now. Let's go to that question.
Hi, Gary Wheaton again up in New Hampshire. Mentioned at the end of the conversation about enhanced interrogation, or at this point, I guess it's limited to the Army or military manual limitations, if you will, which are, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, a lot more limited, you know, limited to Geneva Convention and some other things, a lot more limited than even the limited domestic FBI interrogation techniques. But I could be wrong there. So, you know, my question for you guys is, you know, there's obviously, to me, a real definable difference between enhanced interrogation that is effective potentially or proven to be effective and torture. I mean, torture to me is a very different definition. That's inflicting pain for no purpose or reason whatsoever. So, again, we can define in the differences. But I'd love the comments from or information from you guys on the legal, international and domestic, on that. And I'll leave it there.
Well, this is Steve, and I'll just say a couple comments. I'm sure maybe Adam, Phil have thoughts to add. I do think it is universally recognized that there is some distance, some gap between what is authorized in the current Army Field Manual and what is consistent with both U.S. statutory law other than the National Defense Authorization Act provision that requires use only of the Army Field Manual, but other legal standards, and what is consistent with international humanitarian law and international limitations on treatment of detainees in armed conflict context, et cetera. So there is a gap. But quite obviously, I think the Obama administration made a policy decision coming in that, as a default matter, it was going to limit itself to the Army Field Manual. The president did constitute a high-value detainee task force or group, interrogation group, to consider whether to use additional interrogation practices in individual cases of high-value detainees where there was a strong need to obtain information, et cetera, to protect the United States. But I believe that group ended up coming back to the president and advising that they did not see a need to develop anything further, and it was kind of left hanging. And the administration just simply, either because as a policy matter it agreed with the principle, or because it simply had no interest in pushing the issue, arguing for anything different, it agreed with Senator McCain and other leaders in Congress to the terms of the National Defense Authorization Act, which now limits all agencies of the United States to those very limited set of interrogation, approved interrogation practices in the Army Field Manual, which are designed to comply with the prisoner of war standards under the Geneva Convention, and that any interrogation practice used must be publicly disclosed. There can be no classified annexed to the Army Field Manual. And I think in terms of the protection of the country and the potential need in this war against terrorist groups going forward, there are arguments to be made as to why we should have more sophisticated tools and very limited sets of authorizations that go beyond that. But there's clearly no willingness in the Obama administration to advance those arguments at all. From the get-go, this was an issue where they simply wanted to wipe the slate clean and just go back to the Army Field Manual and not develop any legal analysis whatsoever as to, you know, what the additional tools might be in that gap that I described. So that's definitely the state of play, as you see with all of the most all of the Trump administration nominees in their confirmation hearings They recognize that the current law is what it is, and as long as it is what it is, those are the rules of the road, which I believe is the right answer. And whether they attempt to go back to the well with Congress on this issue is a big, big question. And I think, you know, there's a big hurdle to get over there. But I invite Adam or Phil to chime in.
Yeah, this is Phil. I'll jump in and say I'm not sure that's how I'd characterize the Obama administration's approach to this. I think in 2008, during the transition, 2009, there is an enormous amount of legal energy poured into this topic and a great deal of legal analysis. And a lot of that started from the premise articulated by the Supreme Court in Hamdan that common Article III applied. And so there was a floor as a matter of international law and also as a matter of domestic law because of our adherence to Geneva that we could not go beneath when it came to detainee treatment. And that gap that you speak of techniques that fall between the Army Field Manual and accepted practice and what might be illegal was felt by pretty much everyone around the table to be quite small, that there was no one in the intelligence community coming to the president and saying, boss, we want the flexibility to do X. And I think a large part of that reflects the relative diminution in value of interrogation over the last 10 years, that between the time of these techniques' use in 2002 and 2003, and now the rest of our intelligence portfolio is so much more robust. We have SIGINT, we have forensic intelligence, we have so much more capability now. And I think the second big factor is that the intelligence community feels really burned. They feel like they held the bag for the Bush administration's rendition to the detention and interrogation program, and they don't want to get their hands dirty again with this program that has such dubious value. And I still don't think you could empirically say one way or the other whether these techniques produced the intelligence for which they're designed, let alone that you could only produce this intelligence that way. So, you know, to the question that was asked, there's universal agreement now, I think, on both sides of the aisle that waterboarding is torture, that most of the techniques articulated in the EIT memos of the mid-2000s constitute torture, that torture is unlawful, that torture will not be gone back to by the U.S., and that it's also ineffective, both in a narrow tactical sense within the booth and in a broader strategic sense in terms of the way that it hurts American interests writ large, and that it undermines our position in the world as well as the rule of law.
Okay, very good. At this point, I will issue a last call for questions. We don't have any questions pending. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star and the pound sign. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are our podcasts of previously recorded calls. Okay, we have another question. Let's go to that caller now.
Thank you. It seems like a lot of these issues in terms of irregular combatants and when a particular engagement ends, a war ends, was all addressed in the Indian Wars, which there's, you know, dozens, if not several dozen of them. Why is there so little legal analysis of the operations in the Indian Wars as it applies to the current war on a similar type of irregular combatant?
I'm going to let our scholars address that question.
I actually think that's a great question, and the implicit premise of the question that there should be more, I think, is a great point. If I can hazard a guess as to why there's so little, it's that the Indian Wars occupy a lamentably marginal place in our sort of national historical consciousness, and I think they probably warrant more attention. And I think if we gave them more attention as a matter of sort of general national history, they would also occupy a larger place in our legal analysis. But as it is, it's sort of the major wars of American history, World War II and World War I and the Civil War and so forth, that loom largest in our national historical memory and that therefore lawyers tend to draw upon for historical analogs when we are confronted with present-day problems. but that's merely an explanation, not a justification.
Yeah, and within the national security community, the military profession in particular, the Indian Wars occupy a curious place alongside small wars like the Philippine Insurrection and the Central America deployments of the 20s and 30s. They're really sort of outside the canon of the military profession. They're thought of as lesser included acts to the great wars of World War I and World War II and the Civil War. And so they're not part of the military professional canon. They're not part of our doctrine. They're thought of as things that we do on the side, with the possible exception of the special operations community or the Marine Corps. These kinds of small wars have never been embraced. And that, by the way, becomes a huge part of the reason why counterinsurgency doctrine had to be reinvented for the U.S. military in 2006 by then General Petraeus, because the military had kind of collectively forgot how to do these things, let alone the legal underpinnings. It's a great idea, and someone should do that study, just as someone should dig more, I think, into the Civil War precedents, the Revolutionary War precedents, and the other messy wars of our history.
Okay, very good. Gentlemen, we are running short on time. I'll give you an opportunity now if you'd like to offer any additional comments or any concluding remarks. Please go ahead. Stephen?
I actually just wanted to make one quick comment. Adam mentioned the duty to protect argument, and I think if I'm not mistaken, that argument was raised publicly by the administration in some way, shape, or form in connection with potential action in Syria against the Assad regime, and maybe also in Libya to justify actions in Libya. So I do think it's very significant that it's completely absent from this document, this report, which I think goes hand in hand with what I noted at the beginning, which was the omission of some of the tougher issues and lessons learned from some of the experiences of the Obama administration with respect mostly to these Libyan and Syrian actions or proposed actions that were not encompassed within the 2001 AUMF. I may be wrong about that, but I think I recall that the duty to protect was something that was raised.
No, absolutely. I'll just jump out of order here since my comment is responsive to Steve's. But yes, absolutely, that was part of their public justification for the Libya operation and for the potential Syria operation that ended up not happening. And that's why its omission from this document, I think, is telling that they've chosen not to make it a part of their legal legacy.
I just want to make a general comment that I really think a lot of the analysis of the report that Phil and Adam offered were very, very interesting, and it, you know, shows why I'm not an academic. And I thought that was interesting. On the topic of interrogation, you know, that's an entirely different topic, and I think there's room for disagreement there. But appreciate the sentiments and the difficult issues that raises, for sure. I appreciate it as much or more than anyone, I can tell you that.
Okay, very good. Phil or Adam, any additional comments you'd like to make?
No, I think beyond just thank you and watch this space, I think we're all anxious to see how the Trump administration flexes its powers and how it articulates or justifies those in the months and years to come.
I agree with Phil, and one specific decision point to watch for. I believe the Civilian Casualties Executive Order requires the next annual public report in May. So if that comes out as scheduled, then that will be an indication that the Trump administration is adhering to that executive order. And if they intend not to release it, they'll have to take some action between now and then.
Yeah, I could, just to jump in, I could see them continuing the drone strike policies in terms of some of the substantive standards, at least for now, but I could easily see President Trump changing the procedure that's applied in making those decisions and delegating things down the chain more as a sort of a general administrative or procedural matter.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. We will have to wait and see as this all develops. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Steve, Phil, and Adam for joining us. We thank you for your time and expertise. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.